from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
South Africa became the first country in the world to grant legal protection against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. That was in 1996, but since then, activists have applied pressure for gay rights protection worldwide. The Middle East in particular has remained particularly resistant to those efforts. In much of the region, sexual relations between men is illegal, punishable by prison sentences, torture, and in some cases, death. Scott Long, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender director of Human Rights Watch, and Ramzi Zakaria, the webmaster and outreach director for the Gay and Lesbian Arab Society, join us for an update on the state of gay rights in the Middle East, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to my show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
At the annual session of the UN Human Rights Commission in 2003, Brazil brought forward a resolution that expressed deep concern at the occurrence of violations of human rights in the world against persons on the grounds of their sexual orientation. And that resolution was blocked by five countries: Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Egypt, Libya, and Malaysia. All Muslim countries. Were they the only countries that really objected?
Well, no. They were the most vocal countries, but what you really saw in 2003 and again at the UN in 2004 was a sort of unholy alliance of fundamentalisms where these states spearheaded the effort, but they were strongly supported by the Vatican, the Holy See, and also by coalitions of U.S. Christian fundamentalist groups. And there's where some of the oddness of the coalition comes in, because many of these groups have nothing but contempt for Islam and for Muslim cultures. But around the issue of sexuality and raising fears of sexuality, they were able to build this strange alliance.
And yet, and one of the complaints that we hear from people in some of the Muslim countries is that this tolerance is an imposition of Western values, so it gets a little more complicated, obviously. And isn't it true that Jamaica has one of the worst gay rights records in the world?
Well, there's an extraordinary level of violence directed at lesbian and gay people in Jamaica. You have a democratic government, you have a functioning democracy with civil rights for many people, but you also have this archaic sodomy law that is actually an inheritance of British colonialism, but it's used to justify the argument that because gays and lesbians and transgender people are outlaws, you can do anything to them that you want.
Ramzi, two of the countries that blocked the resolution, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, have horrible gay rights records in the Middle East. Are their attitudes representative of the region, even among the countries that didn't vote with them?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that, you know, those attitudes prevail, you know, in most Arab governments at this point.
So is it fair to link anti-gay attitudes with contemporary conservative Muslim values?
Oh, I don't know if I would go that far. I think that within Islam right now, as you may be aware, there is quite a bit of conflict as far as representation, as far as reform, and so on. However, definitely the issue of gay rights and civil rights in general is being used as weapon.
I don't know which of you would know the answer to this, so I throw it out to both of you. The UN Human Rights Commission is currently in session. Is there another resolution to protect gay rights on the table?
Well, there's not a resolution that's specifically dedicated to the subject, but one of the most important UN resolutions is the resolution on extrajudicial executions, which is basically about killing people, and it says that killing people is wrong. There has been language in that resolution for several years which says that killing people based on their sexual orientation is wrong, and language has been added to it this year which addresses killings based on gender identity. And both these phrases are under attack, and I think it's emblematic of what they do here, because these conservative forces, Christian fundamentalists and Islamic states, use the fact that the resolution addresses sexual orientation and gender identity to undermine the fact that the resolution also addresses women's rights and says that, for instance, crimes of passion, honor killings of women are wrong. And then they use that to try to undermine the resolution's the resolution itself. And, you know, we see that attacks on sexuality again and again are used as a stalking horse for attacks on basic principles of human rights, equality and non-discrimination for everybody.
Ramsey, hasn't the situation actually been exacerbated since 9/11?
Oh, absolutely.
Now, what happened there?
Well, I think for a lot of gays and lesbians who actually used to seek haven in Europe and in the United States, the situation for them became much more difficult, as there has been, you know, a stronger crackdown on or strict enforcement of immigration laws, and you know, particularly for people coming from the Arab world and the Middle East. And so on both a social level and also on a political level, it has made the situation quite hard.
Is that partly because some Middle Eastern and Muslim countries feel that international pressure to protect gay rights is part of a crusade against their values that actually went into full force after 9/11, when people started complaining about seeing a war developing between Muslim attitudes and the rest of the world?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, I frankly don't see that coming necessarily from the Arabic side or from the Muslim side as much as I've seen it coming out of, you know, the mass hysteria that we've experienced here in the West. I didn't see anything equivalent on the other side, where about, you know, there has been increased anti-gay activity because of what happened after 9/11 and, you know, what this administration has tried to portray as a war of civilizations.
Well, one of the arguments countries in the Middle East have put forth when talking about international gay rights is that Western countries are trying to impose their values on the rest of the world. They will link it with what happened in Iraq, for example. Is that commonly thought, or is that just one of the arguments, Scott, that you describe as being the battleground for rights talk versus culture talk?
Well, you know, the real values that the U.S. government is trying to impose in, for instance, the Middle East right now have nothing to do with sexuality. They're the values of a security state, because we want to use Middle Eastern governments to interrogate and to torture people whom we suspect of being unfriendly to the U.S., and I've seen cases of this happening over and over. And one of the consequences is that you get stronger security forces, more impunity for torture, more of a culture of torture in these countries, and of course more state surveillance, which affects everybody, but also affects everybody's private life. In this recent case in Saudi Arabia, The men at a private party were actually arrested by Saudi security forces, who were in the neighborhood in Jeddah pursuing actions against suspected insurgents. And, you know, they happened to see, so far as we can make out, they happened to see the evidence of a private party going on that looked suspect and decided they could add another feather to their cap by raiding it. I think that's a direct instance of how the security culture that the U.S. is promoting actually affects these countries. But, you know, it's very paradoxical for them to say that promotion of gay rights is a Western imposition, when in fact many of these countries, Pakistan, for instance, in the arguments that they're making here at the United Nations around sexual orientation, are actually borrowing language, borrowing rhetoric, borrowing arguments from Christian fundamentalists in the U.S.
Some people argue that there actually is a long tradition of homosexuality in Middle East and Muslim countries, that it was always understood to exist, wasn't challenged, as long as it was kept out of the mainstream.
Oh, I totally agree. And what I would add also to what Scott just said is that, you know, this whole issue has always been used as a convenient card to go after undesirables, political undesirables, you know, within other categories. In other words, in Saudi Arabia or even in Egypt, you know, if you want to go after somebody who may be an activist or a Muslim brother or a communist or whatever group that is undesirable by the authority, this would be a very convenient way to go after them. However, now what we are seeing in Saudi Arabia and what we recently saw in Egypt is more of a sign that they're beginning to focus more on arresting and harassing gays just because of the fact that they are
Well, what happens? How? What kinds of sentences can people be given just for being ascertained as being gay?
In Egypt, under a law against what is called debauchery, people can be sentenced to up to 3 years in prison. I do want to stress.
How do they define debauchery?
Pardon?
How do they define debauchery?
There are legal precedents which say that debauchery is sex between men. The specific legal provision is that you basically have it has to be habitual, so you have to have sex with more than one person over a 3 year period. But they're not exactly precise about applying the definitions in the law.
So debauchery would not apply to prostitution or adultery or other crimes that heterosexuals might engage in?
The provision comes from what was actually a law against prostitution, which was passed at the time that Egypt was regaining full independence in the 1950s. And there was a lot of agitation against the fact that the British and the British Army had been keeping licensed brothels in Egypt for their troops. But, you know, there was a sort of moral panic and this sweep of moral fervor, and they included all of these terms in the law, which allowed them to criminalize other kinds of sexual activity as well.
And what happens in Saudi Arabia when people are arrested for engaging in homosexual activity?
Saudi Arabia enforces Sharia law, the Hanbali school of Sharia law, which is particularly strict. It's not so much codified as subject to the interpretations of religious judges. What we've seen in most cases is that people who are arrested there get sentences of a year or more in prison accompanied by multiple lashes. Some of the defendants in this recent case are going to be flogged 2,000 times. The lashes are usually spaced out over an extended period so that every 15 days or so they'll get 20, 30 lashes. But these kinds of beatings are clearly torture. And moreover, the psychological agony of sitting in a prison cell and waiting for the next time that you're going to be beaten till your back is raw is also a terrifying experience for people. In theory, under Saudi Arabian Sharia law, death could be a penalty. And there have been reports over the last few years of people being beheaded for homosexual conduct as well.
So, Ramsey, what does that mean to people who are living in the area? What effect do the raids like the one we saw in Saudi Arabia have on the mental state of gays in the Middle East?
I think it's beginning to really take its effect. I think prior to that, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these actions were seen as, you know, scapegoats, or as seen as a carte blanche to go after, you know, other entities and other groups. However, people are realizing more and more that, you know, the target now is actually, you know, gays and lesbians, primarily because of the visibility that we are experiencing in the whole region. I think it's mobilizing people, and we're beginning to see that happening in not obviously not in Saudi Arabia, but in countries like Lebanon and like in Egypt. And what's interesting to note here is that the fact that a lot of the laws that are on the book do not specifically mention homosexuality, but are much more vague and talk about things like unnatural acts and mm-hmm. debauchery and so on. And this, in a way, is working to our advantage. And the case in point would be in Lebanon, where we have law number 534, which essentially talks about unnatural acts, and it affects both heterosexuals and homosexuals. So fighting for the repeal of that law works more to our advantage because we can make the case that this is affecting everybody.
Just last month, a unanimous panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled that a gay man from Lebanon was entitled to be considered for asylum in the United States based on his reasonable fear of prosecution if he were to return home. How significant is that ruling, and do you think that it will mean an exodus of gays from Middle Eastern countries?
I think it's quite significant. However, it's really important to note here that in the case of this young man, the fact that he actually was coming from an area that was a highly religious area, and he actually did experience quite a bit of difficulty convincing the judges on that, because Lebanon is such a mosaic, and so the part of the country where he came from, which was the south, which is mainly controlled by religious groups such as Hezbollah. Yes, in his case, obviously, you know, the case was made very clearly that, you know, his life was threatened and so on. However, when you go further north to places like Beirut and Tripoli, where you have a much more visible gay life, or you have gay clubs and you have restaurants and cafes, you know, it will be much harder for people from these areas to make a similar case. That said, we will see, I think, more and more people, and we are already witnessing a lot of people that approach our organization and saying, you know, can you hook me up, can you help me, can you put me in touch with lawyers, et cetera, et cetera.
We're talking with Ramzi Zachariah, webmaster and outreach director for the Gay and Lesbian Arab Society, and Scott Long of Human Rights Watch here on our unreported segment today on the Leonard Lopate Show. We will continue right after this. And we're back with Scott Long, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender director of Human Rights Watch, and Ramzi Zachariah, the webmaster and outreach director for the Gay and Lesbian Arab Society. We're talking about the situation for gays in the Middle East, and most specifically Egypt and Saudi Arabia, where a number of recent events have caused alarm. Let's talk about Egypt a bit more, Scott. Many men have sex with other men in Egypt, but most would not identify themselves as gay or homosexual because those words are from other languages and other traditions. So how would they identify themselves?
Well, I think a lot of men do identify as gay in Egypt, if only because there aren't a lot of words in Egyptian Arabic that can actually be used for a positive self-identification. But a lot of men don't really think of their sexualities along those lines and along those axes of, you know, what is the gender of the person I'm attracted to. A lot of men are much more concerned about, you know, the role that they play in bed, or think more simply fluidly about sexuality as something that can have a lot of objects and go in a lot of directions. What you increasingly find, though, is that the government, the legal system, and society have started to single out a category of men, and the term khawal in Egyptian Arabic, which you can, I suppose, roughly translate as faggot, has become, you know, an incredibly powerful term of abuse for men who are seen as effeminate in particular.
Ramzi, what's your experience in this debate over identity? You're a Palestinian, aren't you?
Right, indeed.
Did you think of yourself as gay when you were in the Middle East?
No, of course not, and primarily because of the fact that, you know, I simply was not aware of the concept of a gay identity the way we know it over here in the West, and it wasn't really until years later when I came to the U.S. and kind of discovered an entity known as the gay community that I actually, you know, realized, you know, what the deal is. That said, I always knew that I was attracted to people of, you know, of the same sex, and I always knew as such I was different. That said, I realized I wasn't alone. I was lucky enough to grow up in an urban environment in Beirut, which, you know, just like many other urban areas all over the world, serves as a haven for a lot of gays and lesbians. And so, you know, I was aware that people like me existed. We simply did not have a label to tag on us.
Well, maybe I've gotten this wrong, but I've always understood that there was homosexual activity among younger people, often because the Quran prohibits heterosexual activity before marriage, but says nothing about homosexual activity. Is that correct?
I don't know about that. That sounds a bit Orientalist to me. I think that the same goes across all groups and all religions. I think that, you know, young people will experiment in sex, you know, wherever you find them. I don't think that this is necessarily something influenced by the Quran or any other religion.
We've been talking about gay men. What's the situation for bisexual, lesbian, and transgendered people? In fact, are there any transgendered people in the Middle East that anyone would know about?
There are actually several states, including Iran and recently, for a period, Kuwait, which allow sex reassignment surgery. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of cultural niches over the years in which transgender people could locate themselves in Middle Eastern countries. I mean, the very term khawal in Egyptian slang, which has become such a term of abuse now, in the 18th and 19th centuries, it seems to have been a pretty neutral term that was used for male transvestite dancers who were often invited to perform at weddings as a sort of respectable substitute for women dancers. So there have been places and times when people we would call transgender have been able to flourish, but I think in a lot of Arab countries, as in a lot of places around the world, prejudice has been growing.
Well, in the case of...
I was in Egypt in 2003. There was a case where a trans person, a man who was dressing in women's clothes, was arrested by the police and charged with fraud for pretending to be a woman. And I think cases like that are probably also growing.
What's happening with women? Does anybody have any idea whether... what the situation is for lesbians, because women are so segregated?
Well, I mean, Ramsey may have a lot to say about this as well, but I think it's much harder for lesbians to develop a sense of community and identity, partly because, you know, for cultural and economic reasons, it's much harder for women to claim public space in many Middle Eastern societies. There are certainly communities of lesbians that I know about and I met people from in Egypt, for instance. They tend to be very much underground, not publicly visible at all. The kind of gay subculture that was existing in places like Cairo and Beirut, a lot of which is about bars and pubs and going out, you know, that's not really an option for lesbian women. It's a much more subdued and quiet scene.
Ramsey, you have anything to add?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Scott. I think, in a society that's still quite patriarchal and quite tribal in its makeup, you know, women already are having a hard time, you know, just organizing and getting together without, you know, without adding the extra label of being a lesbian. That said, I think there's obviously quite a few, quite a lot of Arab lesbians that I know of, you know, and mainly they organize out here in the West. But I think also... some aspect of the society, and I'm thinking in terms of places like Saudi Arabia, where women tend to be segregated, that, you know, has allowed, you know, women to get together in private salons and organize as such, but really very, very limited, and it's usually limited to more of the upper class. Yeah.
Do gay Arabs tend to be more pro-Western, less religious? Are there very religious gay Muslims?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is an organization called Al-Fatiha, which essentially gathers people of the Muslim faith, you know, that are religious. That said, I think...
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to quite a lot of gay Egyptians, for instance, who are quite devout believers. But I think, you know, it's a big source of conflict because the religious orthodoxy that they're exposed to, the kinds of religious rhetoric that they hear... is very intolerant of them and intolerant of who they are. And the struggle to carve out a space within Islam for dissent about sexuality is going to be a very important struggle. It's important not just for gays and lesbians. It's important for the larger cause of women's rights in the region, for instance. But it's going to be a long struggle, and it's going to be a hard one.
My guests are Scott Long of Human Rights Watch and Ramsey Zachariah, the webmaster and outreach director for the Gay and Lesbian Arab Society. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Scott, you've been talking about the time you spent in Egypt, which has the largest gay community in the Middle East. Several years ago, the nightclubs along the Nile in downtown Cairo were kind of a tourist destination for gay Middle Easterners. What happened? Was it raid on the Queen Boat Discotheque?
I think the government was feeling insecure. For 15 or 20 years, it had been facing serious pressure and insurgencies from Islamic groups. In the late 90s, they finally reached a sort of tentative agreement with most of the Islamist groups, and they needed to show that the government needed to show that it was you know, a defender of authentic cultural values and defending Islam. They also needed to stage a distraction from just the fact of mass immiseration. I mean, a population of 65 million, most of whom, two-thirds of whom are probably living under the poverty level, from the fact that as a virtual client state of the U.S., Egypt had been unable to intervene effectively in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict during the Second Intifada. And creating a huge case and a huge hullabaloo about homosexual conduct was very convenient for them on a lot of levels.
They also use it as a political ploy. During the Queen Boat raid, men were arrested and tortured, and 2 months before the trial, their names and places of employment were published in state-controlled newspapers, along with allegations that they were Israeli sympathizers who held orgies, and Satanists who practiced perverted religious rituals. Sounds like they were covering pretty much every possible crime an Egyptian could commit.
They were. And in that specific case in 2001, there was also another political motive. The lead defendant came from a very prominent political family in Egypt. There had been tensions between his family and the ruling family, the Mubarak family. And they really wanted to humiliate him and drag his name through the mud in every possible way to send a message to that family and to anyone else who would dare to criticize the president. It's that kind of regime. But in the process, they sent a message to every vice squad officer throughout the country that arresting homosexuals would get your name in the paper and would be good for your career.
Ramsey, did that raid also become a rallying cry for gay Middle Easterners?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the past when we usually discuss this particular raid, we refer to it as our own Stonewall. So yeah, I mean that raid really opened a lot of eyes. And I think if anything that came out of that was the visibility. We were on the map, and suddenly Arab media and Arab press was actually talking about an entity known as gay and lesbian Arabs. And from there, that also encouraged other groups to start locally organizing.
What was the response of Western countries? Did the United States protest? Did any European countries protest?
There was a considerable amount of protest. And even the U.S. government under the Bush administration sent observers to some of the Queen Boat trials and issued statements in protest. But, you know, I think one thing we find is that it's very hard to get advocates for reform, even in many of these countries, human rights activists, to take these cases seriously. At the beginning of the Queen Boat case, most human rights organizations in Egypt said, we will have nothing to do with this. Now, after 4 years almost, there is a body of human rights activists and organizations in Egypt who see these cases as important, who see issues of private life and personal freedom as crucial. And that's partly because they've seen, you know, if the government can raid gay men's homes and send informers into them, they can also do that with political dissidents, they can do that with student leaders, they can do that with intellectuals. And so there's beginning to be an understanding that it all connects.
Ramsey, let's talk a bit about the role that the Internet plays in gay life in the Middle East. It is simultaneously a way to find a community and meet people and a way to get targeted by the police, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the Internet on one side has been a lifesaver for many of us out there. In terms of getting in touch with each other, in terms of organizing, in terms of joining mailing lists, and so on and so on. And then we're still exploring, the capabilities of the new medium and as we put them to work towards this particular cause. On the other side of the coin, as you mentioned, it has been used to entrap people, particularly in Egypt and also in Lebanon. In Tripoli, there was a case where people were entrapped using the internet by the local vice police and so on. So it's a double-sided coin.
So I'm sure gay men are becoming fearful of meeting anyone online. Are there other ways to meet people?
I think we're becoming more savvy on how we use the internet, and I think the nice part about it is that we're always like a few steps ahead.
I know Human Rights Watch has documented cases of internet entrapment, Scott, but this is probably not unique to the Middle East, is it?
No, it's not at all. You can face violence and you can face discrimination here in the United States, obviously, even on the streets of New York. And there are many, many countries around the world in which violence, torture, even killings of gay men are everyday occurrences. I think what was so painful about what happened in Egypt was that you had had the beginnings of a cohesive community of people who looked after each other, who cared for each other. And the state stepped in with really terrific force and brutality to break that up and bring it to an end.
So what is the future of gay rights in the Middle East?
It's going to be a long fight again. I remember talking to a 19-year-old kid who was arrested when the police in Egypt wiretapped someone's home and then rounded up everyone who incriminated themselves as gay over the telephone. And this kid told me how, while he was in the jail cell, he and 13 other men, at every change of shift, three times a day, the guards would come in and shout, "Down on your faces, Kawalat, down on your faces, faggot," and then stamp on their backs with their boots. And one day, they opened the door. School children, 6 or 7 years old, and they shouted, "Down on your faces, Kawalat," and then stomped on the men's backs with their boots and showed the children how to do it, and then invited the children to join in. And it was like a school trip. It was a message that this is how men who have sex with men end up in Egypt. When you have a whole society in the grips of a moral panic that dedicates itself to inculcating those values in its children, it's going to take a long time to overcome that. But I think there are really courageous activists throughout the Middle East and in the diaspora, like Ramzi, who are fighting this fight every day. And through the visibility that they win, ultimately those values will change.
Ramzi, are you any more optimistic than Scott?
Slightly. I think the situation in the area, of course, will all depends on you know, the changes that the whole region is going through, both on a political and social level. I tend to be slightly more optimist just because I'm seeing on a day-to-day basis the effect that the information and media revolution is that's happening over there is doing. In terms of people getting in touch with each other, especially getting in touch with the West, you know, it is quite common. The other day I was talking with a young man in Beirut on the internet, and he was asking me about the what's going on with the latest episodes of Queer as Folk, which, you know, in my youth I would have never imagined ever anything closely remote to that. So I think the world is getting smaller. People are getting more and more exposed. In that sense, that makes me slightly more optimist, but I would still say that it all depends on the overall changes that are about to occur in the region and that are occurring as we speak.
Thank you both so much for participating in today's underreported segment. I've been talking with Ramzi Zacharia of the Gay and Lesbian Arab Society and Scott Long of Human Rights Watch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.